From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Today's show features a forum on U.S. foreign policy in the 1980s. We'll hear from Milwaukee filmmaker Chip Duncan, who produced a public TV documentary on the Reagan presidency.
I think the core theme that emerges from the second 2 hours of our film is really that you see the Cold War come to an end and you see the war on terror begin.
Plus, how ready to confront the Soviet Union was Ronald Reagan when he took office?
He did not think in the early years of his presidency that there was any potential for detente, although there were significant pressures. Let's make a deal. Let's reduce the tension.
And how is Mikhail Gorbachev seen in Russia today?
Unfortunately, now his popularity is very low.
Lake Effect comes your way next after news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Thanks so much for tuning in today. The 1980s were a pivotal decade for the world. As the decade opened, the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan and set up what proved to be one of the last showdowns of the Cold War. President Ronald Reagan and his administration pursued a foreign policy aimed squarely at bringing down the influence of communist governments in Europe and elsewhere. 30 years later, what is the legacy of that era of U.S. policy, both here and in the former Soviet Union? Today on the show, we'll hear an excerpted version of a forum featuring three people with a unique view. Chip Duncan is a Milwaukee-based filmmaker who produced a 3-hour documentary on the Reagan presidency for public television. Richard Friedman advised members of the Reagan administration in that era. He's now a senior fellow with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. And Svetlana Savranska grew up in the Soviet Union and had a front row seat as the Iron Curtain came down. She's now senior fellow at George Washington University's National Security Archives. The forum was moderated by Lake Effect's Mitch Teich, who asked Richard Friedman how fully formed the Reagan foreign policy was as he took office.
The wonder of our gathering tonight is for us to assess where we are now and to take a look backward as you frame the issue and to see if there's any continuity. But in order to answer your question, during those years, you had to take a look at the prior decade. And that prior decade was the period end of World War II, next 15 or 20 years, where the Soviet Union at that time, was embarked on what we believed to be aggression. The term axis of evil was current. Many of you will remember Senator Joe McCarthy from Wisconsin, of course, and his view of anti-communism. At that point, it was part of the American ethos. So he inherited a disposition of the American people, the American culture. And the first thing that he did in 1980 through his confidant, Cap Weinberg, was to increase U.S. defense, which had fallen into disrepair in the prior 4 years under the Carter administration. And I think that he had a view of the decade ahead. And he did not think in the early years of his presidency that there was any potential for detente, although there were significant pressures. Let's make a deal. Let's reduce the tension. He thought at that time that that was going to be an impossibility, and the only way to reach a negotiated deal would take a great deal of time, perhaps not even within his presidencies. But his strong belief was muscle, muscle against their muscle, in order to demonstrate that if a deal were to be made, it would have to be made on a term that would involve comprehensive removal of nuclear weapons, cessation of Russia's what we call meddling abroad, their iron-fisted, his words, iron control of the Central European countries. So It's easy to look back and say he was off course, but I think that if we put ourselves in the position of others during the 1980s, he had a pretty good idea of what the road would look like ahead.
Svetlana Savranska, how quickly did Soviet leaders recognize that Ronald Reagan was going to represent a departure from how the U.S. was engaging Soviet leaders in the years leading up to that point?
I think the Soviet leaders realized that even before Reagan came to power. One just has to look at his radio addresses to know where he was coming from. But I also think that crediting Reagan, just Reagan, with significant increases in military budget is not completely accurate. And the Soviets already felt the brunt of the last year of the Carter administration after the invasion of Afghanistan. Carter actually significantly increased the military budget, and then Reagan increased it even more. The difference was the Soviets felt that Reagan had this evil empire kind of heavy ideological polarizing rhetoric. And for the Soviets, he looked, sounded even more threatening in the future than he actually turned out to be. But there was a growing expectation in the Soviet Union that times will change, and détente was already over.
Chip Duncan, your film makes the point that even if the United States and Soviet Union were not actually literally going to go to war with each other at that point, there were numerous other places around the world that could serve as a proxy for the interests of the superpowers, right?
Well, there certainly were plenty of proxies in Central America and in the Middle East. I think what's interesting about the Middle East in particular is that in some cases, like Syria, there was a proxy element to it. But in others, you know, it was really U.S. and Israeli foreign policy that was driving a lot of the conflict there.
Richard Friedman, maybe you're the person to answer this question. Maybe it's you, Chip Duncan. Is there a direct line to be drawn between how the U.S. was perceived coming out of the civilian massacre that took place in Lebanon and how the U.S. is perceived in the Middle East today?
The answer to your question is affirmative, but it's a marker. The event that you just saw portrayed here, as dastardly as it was, needs to be put in context. And if you go back 10 years before, there were the stirrings of militant Islamic radicalism. The card that they had not played was the energy card, and they knew that they had muscle there. And it was not apparent at the time of this, let's call it a massacre, that let's use a metaphor, the cork was going to come out of the bottle. And I believe in retrospect that the beginning of militarism in the Mideast, that's the marker. We were very naive. The United States did not have a strategy in the Mideast. And I don't think that in the ensuing 10 or 20 years that we ever developed a strategy. There were a bunch of tactical responses. So if you trace that year forward, the beginning of Hamas, Hezbollah, a lot of other military splinter groups that occurred, caught the United States flat-footed. And we have always, at least for the ensuing 30 years, were doing catch-up.
Well, and Svetlana, if it's taken as a given that this conflict in Lebanon was not a proxy for the Cold War, where was the Soviet Union in these terms, in this context? What was the Soviet Union's interest in the Middle East at that stage?
Well, the Soviet Union at the time was involved in the war in Afghanistan, and a lot of the Soviet interest at the moment, again, is focused on Afghanistan. However, in the more general Middle Eastern conflict, the Soviet Union traditionally was on the side of the Arabs. And especially in late 1970s, was trying to help the Palestinians. Where I would add to this discussion is that, like Richard said, a lot of where we're now could be traced back to the Middle East. In Afghanistan, the Reagan administration was obviously, like the Carter administration began, helping Mujahideen. And the main criteria for which groups to help was who is the most anti-Soviet group, which happened to be the groups which were also radically fundamentalist Muslim group, like, for example, the group led by the by Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. And the Soviets and a lot of the Europeans, actually, at the time, were warning the Reagan administration that this unqualified support for those radical groups could lead to strengthening of the Islamic fundamentalism. And even when the Geneva Accords were negotiated and the United States and the Soviet Union were guarantors, the United States eventually did not stop the outside funding for those forces, which led, not surprisingly, to the fact that they were the groups that came to power once the Soviet Union withdrew.
Now, Richard, I want to stick with the continuity, or the chronology, rather, here, because I think this is all going on as the Reagan administration's plans for the Strategic Defense Initiative, what was called Star Wars, were coming to fruition. And I'm curious whether you saw how much of SDI was about actual missile defense and how much was about an economic strategy.
In 1983, I served on the U.S. Army Science Board, and I was on the executive committee for ballistic missile defense. And the technology people came up with what is now called as Star Wars, SDI, Star Wars, where we would be able to intercept a missile in mid-flight. And there was a meeting with President Reagan where he was as befuddled as I was about the technology. But he asked a couple of quick questions. One, is this stuff perfect? And the answer was no. Well, how long would it take to get it perfect? Maybe never, but at least a decade. And then the killer question was how much it's going to cost. I can't remember the numbers, but it was very significant. And then he said something that was enormously prescient. Go back to 1983, a bold, strong Russia. And he said, this is an opportunity to spend them into bankruptcy. Whatever we spend, they're going to have to spend the equivalent of 10 times more. And this is an opportunity not only to protect ourselves, but perhaps more importantly, it's a way to take the economic pillars out from under the Soviet Union.
Svetlana, did SDI have that effect?
No, it didn't. And this is one of the more interesting stories, which is kind of, you know, based on mythology, but the closer you look at it, it didn't. So what happened in 1983, when Reagan first, in March 1983, makes the speech announcing the SDI, the effect it had on the Soviet Union was really terrifying. Because initially, the Soviet leadership took it seriously. And it ordered its scientists to look into the question and determine, A, if it's doable, B, how much would it cost to the Soviet Union. They came with the same conclusion on one question, but with a very different on the other. They determined that the Soviet Union would have to spend astronomically more than the United States to match that system. But the Soviets already had some research of SDI elements. They looked at laser weapons in space. And they concluded that it would be very difficult to accomplish. And in the big study, which was completed by the fall of 1983, the Soviet scientists, specifically Velikhov, they said it will not work. It will not work, and therefore we should not invest anything in it. There is a cheaper way to confront it, and that is increase our offensive capabilities, which means build more launchers, which the Soviets were very good at, and build more MIRV missiles, and build more decoys to overwhelm that system if and when it is built. So they called it the asymmetric response. And that was the decision that was made, that rather than developing its own SDI and trying to match the United States, which would bankrupt us, we would invest in an asymmetrical response. Then in 95 and 96, Gorbachev comes to the same question. He asks his scientists again to do a detailed study of what Americans have done and what we should do. And they look at it and they said, well, everything Americans have done has not worked yet. There's not even a working prototype. They're not anywhere close. And they repeated the same conclusion. We should not try to emulate it. We have a cheaper answer to that. Now, the next question, and this is really important, were the Soviets scared of SDI? Yes, they were. They were genuinely scared of SDI, not because they thought it would work as this impenetrable defense. What the Soviets saw in SDI was a possibility of putting weapons in space and attacking objects on the ground with weapons based in space. And for them, it looked like a creation of this new possible blitzkrieg system of a first strike from space. And this is why the Soviets were afraid of SDI, not because they thought that America would build this impenetrable shield that would be able to protect America and make America invincible.
Chip.
That particular point is the bone of contention and really the primary debate at both Geneva and Reykjavik, just how afraid the Soviets were of that particular idea.
That's filmmaker Chip Duncan. We'll have more from the forum when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Stephanie Lecce. We're listening today to a forum on U.S. foreign policy at the end of the Cold War. It was recorded earlier this month at the University Club of Milwaukee. Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke moderated the discussion with a three-person panel: Milwaukee filmmaker Chip Duncan, who produced a documentary on the Reagan presidency, Richard Friedman of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, and Svetlana Savronska with George Washington University's National Security Archives. Savronska grew up in the Soviet Union and was in college at Moscow State University as the relationship between President Reagan and Soviet Premier Mikhail Gorbachev warmed up. She talked about how things changed in her country as Gorbachev came to power.
Sometimes my students, when I show them this film, they say, why do you say he moved? Well, because the three leaders before him, Brezhnev, late Brezhnev, could not walk on his own. Andropov was in his hospital room most of the time. And Chernenko, about half of the time, was in his hospital room, and they staged how he voted. So within the system, there was an understanding that things had to change. The average age of the Politburo when Gorbachev comes to power is 72. So they knew they needed new blood. Plus, Gorbachev was a protege of Andropov. So he was kind of standing in the wings. People knew he would be coming to power. Nobody, of course, expected anything what he brought with him, a complete rethinking of the Soviet system and international relations. His main goal, as he expressed in the very beginning, was to end the Cold War so that the Soviet Union could develop economically.
Well, and the point was made, and I'm curious to get all of you to weigh in on this. The point was made, I think, by Condoleezza Rice, that he thought he could reform the Soviet Union, and it seems evident. Did the Reagan administration think that the Soviet Union was reformable?
I think the Reagan administration did not think that the Soviet Union was reformable. But very importantly, the Reagan administration, in my view, did not try to reform the Soviet Union as the, you know, internal structure. What it was trying to do is end the Soviet, what they saw as aggressive behavior internationally, and get the Soviet Union to abide by international norms. And they believed that with time, the Soviet Union internally would simply, you know, the system would collapse. This is what George Kennan said back then in 1946.
It was March of 1988, and there were rumors that President Reagan was going to go to Moscow, and the dimensions of whether or not it was going to become the Moscow summit were not then known. I received a call from a pal of mine, who at that time was the executive secretary of the National Security Council. And he was the lead writer of a three-person team who were preparing a speech, or the dimensions of the speech, that President Reagan would give at some time before he announced publicly that he was going to go to Moscow for the so-called summit. He called me that afternoon, and he alluded to it, called it a hypothetical summit, and a hypothetical president, and all that. But the reason that he called me, he said, what is the reaction of the Midwest if President Reagan opens the door a little bit to the Russians? Remember, the setting, evil empire. And he said, give me a call back tomorrow and send me a letter. There wasn't email at that time. I said, I don't need any additional time. My view was, if he's going to open the door a little bit, why doesn't he open it all the way? What's he going to achieve by sneaking up on a major problem? Put all the cards on the table. Okay, he said. Week later, he said, I have a proposition for you. What's that? That President Reagan wants to give a speech somewhere out of Washington, and we're going to have him come to Chicago, and you and the National Strategy Forum are going to be his host. Terrific. So President Reagan came to Chicago, I think the latter part of March, about 3 weeks before his departure for Moscow, and full house, 1,500 people at the Palmer House, and maybe more importantly, at least 150, maybe more, international news representatives were in the audience. I had the great privilege of introducing him, and I sat next to him, and he stood up, and he did have a teleprompter at that time. I had never seen one, and I was peering over his shoulder as he gave the speech, and there were some quotes that I had given to my pal, the speechwriter, before. If we need to go to Soviet Union, everything is on the table. And the reciprocal of that, of course, is you were there shortly after the speech.
Yes, that was actually an unforgettable experience. And I think for me personally, in my personal life, was when the Cold War ended. I was at Moscow University at the time, actually graduating 2 weeks after Reagan came, May 31st, 1988. I was studying U.S. history, so we were considered to be politically reliable enough to be able to meet with Reagan. And so when he's speaking at Moscow University, I'm sitting literally like Bob from me in the first row, right? Like, it would be a little bit this way, directly across from him. And I, at the time, and all my friends, we didn't know that teleprompters existed. And for us, it was just such an eye-opening experience. We saw the president who was very likable, who spoke eloquently, who kept eye contact, and for the first time we heard anyone publicly speak about human rights. And I remember that appealed so much. We just really, really were impressed. And I remember leaving the meeting, there were lots of news people asking, you know, what was your impression? What was your impression? I was so overwhelmed. I remember I said, he was very human. He was very human, and he spoke about human rights. And I talked to my friends afterwards, and most of us mentioned that, wow, he spoke about human rights. That must be very important for him. And we felt that this guy will not push the button. We just saw him, we heard him speak, and we knew somehow at a very basic human level that this guy is not going to push the button. He's not that aggressor imperialist that we heard about. It's a different time. And then literally the next day on the Red Square, a reporter asked him, well, you spoke about evil empire and now you're here. He actually is standing on the Red Square with the Navy officer carrying the football, which is targeted at the object next to which Reagan is standing. And to this answer, to that question, Reagan says, no, that was another time, another era. And that was just such a symbolic moment in my memory.
There's something else that's going on as this is playing out, and that is the ending of the Cold War, but also the beginning of the War on Terror. Chip Duncan, what ends up happening in this whole period is the bombing of American interests in Lebanon.
Yeah, I think the core theme that emerges from the 2 hours, the second 2 hours of our film, is really that you see the Cold War come to an end and you see the War on Terror begin. Many of us in the room will remember when the embassy was bombed in Beirut and then later the Marine Corps barracks on the runway out at the Beirut airport. And what really happens after that is quite fascinating because the U.S. pulls out. It wasn't called a pull-up, but we pulled out. And at that time, you see a power vacuum take place in Lebanon for the first time because for the most part, at that particular moment, the PLO is less influential. There's a power vacuum, and Hezbollah in particular rises. And as we now know, the consequence of that is that Hezbollah today is quite powerful. And so what many people would call Islamic extremism really begins to emerge at that time. It was fascinating to produce this part of the show because a lot of the discussion around it was coming from people on the right who viewed a lot of the decisions, especially around the U.S. exit, as ultimately detrimental to long-term peace in the region. And I find that fascinating because it's one of those decisions that there's no way you can look 30 years out. You can't foresee 9/11 in 1983. You know, when you have a film that's 3 hours long and there's so much content in it, sometimes you know the sound bites keep going past and you don't necessarily log them and hear them. But for us as filmmakers, that last soundbite of Condi Rice's is probably the most explosive comment in the entire 3 hours. To the extent that even, there was some question about whether the film would air in November or early in 2013. And the general impression by most of the programmers on PBS was to not air the film during our last election, but to let it air later, simply so a lot of the comments weren't politicized. Because clearly for Condi Rice to link 1983 to 2001, I think is pretty sensational.
That, when I think about it, is probably the one example in the Reagan administration that perhaps looking back on it, they might have done differently. It set off then, I think, a whole series of events in Lebanon and in the Middle East that we probably ultimately paid for in terrorism's forward march until we finally had to confront it after September 11th.
Well, and I'm curious, and maybe this is a question for Svetlana, if the lack of response on the part of the United States to these terrorist acts was perceived as weakness on the part of the U.S. Why does that not end up being reflected in how the Cold War is carried out? Or is the Cold War too far gone from the Soviet side for this to embolden the Soviet Union in its efforts against the U.S.?
You know, it was not perceived as weakness because, you know, here we just heard this clip and we're completely focused on that. But if you look in the global context, for the Soviets, it looked like the United States was assertive. If you look about the same time, fall 83, we have the invasion of Grenada. We have consistent support for the Contras in Latin America. We have support for Mujahideen in Afghanistan. We have military budget increases. So it's not at all the perception of the Soviets that the Americans are weak or retreating. And I would say that because for the Soviet Union, it was not such an issue of national security. And in a way, identity, role in the Middle East, it did not become such a focus on which you would change your perception of the United States. The perception was just the opposite. The United States is stronger and more assertive.
We'll take one more break and then return with more of our forum on U.S. foreign policy at the end of the Cold War. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Stephanie Lecce. Let's get back to our special broadcast of a forum on U.S. foreign policy at the end of the Cold War, recorded at the University Club of Milwaukee. Lake Effect's Mitch Teich moderated the discussion, which featured Milwaukee filmmaker Chip Duncan, who produced a PBS documentary on the Reagan presidency, Richard Friedman of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, and Svetlana Savronska of George Washington University. Savronska grew up in the Soviet Union. She was in East Berlin when President Reagan delivered his famous speech from the West Berlin side of the Brandenburg Gate. It was during that speech that he demanded that the Berlin Wall be taken down. That didn't happen until some time later, but Savronska talked about what listeners in East Berlin thought of Reagan's words.
The speech was received very enthusiastically in East Berlin. I happened to be there on an internship from Moscow State University working at the Humboldt University. And as much as the Soviets tried to tone down the reaction and restrict the number of people who could come to the Brandenburg Gate, this was obviously the focus that people discussed. However, in the Soviet Union, it was perceived as pure propaganda and was not taken seriously. At the time, the Soviets were engaged with the Americans in very productive negotiations to scrap the entire class of intermediate-range nuclear weapons in Europe. A major, major treaty, INF Treaty, which was signed in December 1987, the only treaty to this day that completely eliminated a class of most threatening, destabilizing weapons. So when Reagan makes this speech, the Soviets see it as, you know, this is just rhetoric. Nobody believed it either in the Soviet Union, or actually, if you look at the documents of the time in the United States, at that time, not in Germany, not in the United States, not in the Soviet Union, anybody saw a possibility of the wall coming down. Remember, even in 1989, Chancellor Kohl was thinking that Germany would reunite maybe in 10 years. The wall was brought down by East Europeans. And it was a total surprise. It was very unprepared. It was basically a mistake made by the German Politburo, East German Politburo member who announced loosening of restrictions on travel. And people came out into the street and brought the wall down. And the Soviets decided to not move, not use weapons, and restrain, actually, their own forces and send a signal to East German forces not to spill blood, that it was unacceptable to spill blood. That's how the wall came down. It was not because Reagan called for it. It's not because the Soviets decided to do it. It's because first Hungarians were the first who opened their borders in August 1989, and then the Czechs, and then the Germans. So to say that the wall contributed to, that the speech that Reagan made in June 1987 contributed to the fall of the wall, I think is an exaggeration. But that the policy that Reagan pursued in his negotiations with the Soviet Union, in his visit to Moscow in 1988, in ending the Cold War, that created the conditions in which the Soviets did not feel threatened any longer. East Europeans understood that there would be no use of force on the Soviet side, and that is how the wall came down.
So then, Richard Friedman, is the long-term effect of this speech more domestic in nature? Did it have more in the way of winning the Reagan administration political points and pave the way for the Bush election victory?
It would be an overreaction to say that one speech cleared the way. It was a plow that was needed. The conditions were ripe. And for those of us in Milwaukee, I think that if we're thinking about the Cold War, you need to put two pictures up on the wall. One is irrelevant. That's Aaron Rodgers. But the other one ought to be Gorbachev, because the heavy lifting was done, in my view, on the Russian side. And he, in many respects, is an underrated hero. If I may do yet one last vignette. Go back to the time when there was a coup, this amateur coup to throw Gorbachev out of power that could have worked, but it didn't. Move back in time 6 months before. Things were going very well, as Svetlana said. Progress was being made. There was a not only a loosening of the grip, there was warmth. There was actual warmth among the negotiators on both sides. And at that time, the chairman of the chief of staff, Admiral Krau, now deceased, got to be pals with the number two person in the Gorbachev administration, Field Marshal Andrei Akhramelev, Sergei Akhramelev. And the chairman of the Joint Chiefs asked his counterpart, Russian counterpart, to come to Congress, and they made a home-and-home speech. And Akhramelev said he had changed his plans and he wanted to stay in the United States another 2 or 3 days to learn more about America. Admiral Krau called me at home one evening, and he said, "I'm sending Field Marshal Akhramelev to see you in 2 days, and you're to show him America." Akhramelev arrived, and I met him at O'Hare, rented a limousine for the occasion, got in the back seat, he on one side, I went on the other, and there was a Russian colonel in the middle who was the translator. And Akhramelev had a bad day, apparently. He was grimacing and not at all unhappy. And he leaned over to me and he said, through the interpreter, "Why are you so aggressive? You have Canada on the north and Mexico on the south. Why do you have such a big military?" And I looked at him and I said, "You must translate this word for word." And I said to Akhramelev through the translator, "Field Marshal, if you continue this bullshit, we are not going to get along." And he reached over, smiled, patted me on the knee and said, "Da." And we spent 2 days touring farms and shopping mills, shopping malls, the whole works. And as I took him out for breakfast the day that he boarded the plane, he said, "This has been a wonderful experience." And I said, "What are you going to tell Gorbachev?" He said, "Well, when I came here, I knew nothing about America. And when I go back to tell Gorbachev, he knows less about America than I do." And this is the important short sentence, he said. "We in Russia will never catch up to the United States." That was a telling moment.
This is really as good a time as any to turn the conversation over to those of you in the audience with us. Do people have questions? And do we have a microphone ready?
Fast forward to 2013. I'm curious about your view about the influence of oil today going forward to 2020, where we're increasingly becoming independent in terms of oil and, of course, natural gas, and what its oil's influence will be on future Middle Eastern policy over the next 6 to 8 years. In terms of how we should be looking at the Middle East, its importance, its juxtaposition with us, and, of course, even China. And so I know I'm shifting dramatically from President Reagan, but I'm really curious to try and think about how this the Middle East will square with U.S. foreign policy over the next 6 to 8 years.
Great question. Short answer, don't want to be simplistic. But for 70 years, the U.S. foreign policy was wholly dependent on energy, at least in the Midwest. We have a different situation in the Eastern Mediterranean. Many of you will know that within the last year or two, the Israeli government discovered offshore oil, their Leviathan field that moves all the way up to Cyprus. It's both oil and gas. And although it's only about 4% of the total world's energy production, it provides enormous leverage. There's a fork in the road, however. It all depends how this oil card can be played. The countries that are in the region are those that in the non-Arab states, the non-oil producing states, are energy dependent. Turkey, to a great extent, it's Egypt. Certainly, it's Pakistan. And this is an opportunity to play the oil card to achieve a degree, not of peace, but of some political stability. If oil and gas energy can be supplied to domestic consumers, for example, in Pakistan, electricity is on for maybe 15% of the time. And it's unlikely that the Pakistanis will do business with Israel, but it's another source of oil, of energy. And if energy can be used to bring humanitarian well-being, that's a great potential. And it's a small part of the answer that, to the broader question that you've asked, but it can be used for domestic purposes. Overall, I see it as a political stabilizing force.
Other questions from the audience?
I'm curious, if Reagan and Gorbachev were alive today, how do you think they would be dealing with the rise of Islamic terrorism and radicalism, since it obviously affects both nations?
I think there would be much more engagement. I think by the end of the Reagan administration, Reagan and Gorbachev came to an understanding that if they cooperated, if they were in partnership, they could resolve a lot of what they called regional conflicts, local conflicts. And they began working on almost every major conflict that existed in the world. And this interaction in each case was highly positive. It helped the Soviets disengage from Afghanistan. It helped eventually resolve the conflict in Central America. Although, you know, you can see that the United States was dragging its feet and not, you know, in Central America, it was very, very difficult for Reagan to give up his support for the Contras. But then come Bush administration, they were able to resolve this conflict. And they, the Soviets seized armaments, Americans seized arming the Contras. And the peace process under Oscar Arias eventually succeeded, brought free elections. I think what we are lacking today is the engagement in terms of real partnership and willingness on both sides to invest, to not compete and not drive for their own relative gains in the region, but to overcome the conflict cooperatively. And the only exception that I see now is the U.S.-Russian cooperation on Syria, which I would be cautiously optimistic. This is right now the only kind of engagement that reminds me of Reagan and Gorbachev discussing regional conflicts and both deciding that if they work together in that conflict, if they removed the element of competition, then they could, if not resolve, then significantly ameliorate the situation. And both of them realized, were beginning to realize, the threat of Islamic fundamentalism.
I was going to say the same thing about Syria. The big difference being that Gorbachev and Reagan actually liked each other, and Putin and Obama really don't. But they did when it became, you know, past the Security Council, when it finally got to the point where something serious really had to be done, or the U.S. was going to be forced to intervene in Syria. You did see the two of them come together, and I think I could be wrong, but I wouldn't be surprised to see a lot of cooperation around the upcoming Olympics as well, because the threats to both nations are going to be significant.
We have time for two more questions.
How do the Russian people look at Gorbachev in connection or comparison to Stalin, Putin, anybody else in between, up and down the line?
Gorbachev was phenomenally popular in the late 1980s. And unfortunately now, his popularity is very low. Yes, and the popular perception is that he is the one who destroyed the Soviet Union, even though his intention was the opposite. He wanted to liberalize, open up, and make the Soviet Union a democratic socialist Soviet Union. This is what the people wanted, and that is the basis of his popularity in the late 1980s. But after Russia went through truly excruciating decade of the 1990s, a lot of people blame it, simply speaking, on Gorbachev. Unfairly so. And so for many years I was arguing every time I am in Russia that there should be a Gorbachev library or the Gorbachev, like you have presidential libraries here in the United States. And this idea falls flat because there is simply not enough interest and respect, and creating something like that would be controversial. The fall of the Soviet Union, the disintegration of the country, is tied to his name in popular mind. And unfortunately, that makes him not the most popular president. People did realize in the late 80s that their life became so much better under Gorbachev. But then came the 1990s. And having lived through that and destruction of essentially your whole identity, your lifestyle, your well-being, it's all attributed to the policies that Gorbachev pursued.
How does his legacy compare to say, Boris Yeltsin's legacy?
They would compete for the place of the most unpopular leader in the history of the Russian nation. I think right now Yeltsin might be a little more unpopular, but it's questionable. They both are down there.
thanks to all three of our panelists.
You've been listening to a special broadcast of a forum on U.S. foreign policy at the end of the Cold War, recorded earlier this month at the University Club of Milwaukee. The panel was moderated by Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke and featured Svetlana Savranska of George Washington University, Richard Friedman of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, and Milwaukee documentary filmmaker Chip Duncan. You'll find a link to more about his PBS documentary on the Reagan presidency from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.